honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes in an episode that's been a little different today. So often we hear from people who spent World War II in the thick of combat, on the ground, at sea, or in the air. Today we've picked up a little different perspective, but one that I think is just as important and powerful. Like their entire generation, Lewis and Ruth Wagoner had their lives interrupted by the all-consuming, all-hands-on-deck urgency of World War II. They couldn't have imagined their 80th year of marriage that they're working on now, because their future, the future of their three children, and the future of our country were all uncertain. Lou tried to enlist after the attack on Pearl Harbor, but was passed over because he was married and had a young child at home. His first contribution to the war effort came at Mare Island Naval Shipyard in California's Bay Area, which by the end of the war would produce 17 submarines, 31 destroyer escorts, and over 300 landing craft, in addition to repairing ships damaged in the war. By 1944, however, the needs of the growing worldwide effort brought a draft notice to his home, and Lou had to leave Ruth and their three children as he trained to become an aviation radioman and gunner on PBY Catalina flying boats. Japan surrendered before he had to go overseas, and like many of the veterans we meet here on Hometown Heroes, his life after World War II is pretty interesting too. One of the reasons Tom Brokaw famously labeled these Americans as our greatest generation was that after banding together to preserve freedom, they went to work and in many ways built the communities we call home today. For the Wagoners, competitive sailing would eventually yield some significant accomplishments. But Lou's vocation after the war is something many of us who live in California have benefited from without even knowing it. He spent 38 years with the Department of Highways, in some cases designing stretches of road and in others trying to figure out how to fix areas that had proven unsafe.
We had a lot of highways with compound curves. Cars would be driving down the highway. There's a sign that says 35 miles an hour. And you get on this first part of the compound curve, they say, "What the hell are they talking about, 35 miles an hour?" And then you hit, but already you've accelerated and hit it too fast. So that's one of the, I did a lot of corrections, taking out the compound curves, taking out curves that were too tight, realigning a section of the highway or adding a guardrail or a median barrier. I was putting in lots and lots of median barrier. They did the job. I'm taking out the oleanders and putting in the median barrier because, "Oh, you're taking out those beautiful oleanders." Well, when you get to the point where it was having a lot of cross-median accidents, and a lot of times the guys were going the light speed, they'd hit those, and instead of crashing into them and slowing them down, they over the top, and so they hit the traffic in the opposing lane just about windshield high. So they were hazardous under those conditions because they would jump the, yeah.
You mentioned time designing highways too. Is there a particular stretch of road that you're proud of having a role in, or that every time you pass by now, you say, "Hey, I remember when I worked on that"?
Well, yeah, one that I'm pretty happy with was I did the design on 152 from 99 to the Merced County line. I was restricted in what I was allowed to do. I didn't get to design it the way I really wanted to, but the structural section of the highway, so the westbound lanes, the new lanes that we put in, we designed the highway with a surface, a 20-year life for the surface. So you compare asphalt or concrete, whichever goes well. I could justify concrete pavement, and I put those in the 1960s, and it's still about the only concrete pavement that you drive on that doesn't go click, 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 click. It's still smooth. But I had better basement soil to start the structural section that most people had in subgrade. The design, I was restricted by second line supervisor. "You can't do that, Wagoner." So anyway, then the bottom end of the four lane on 168 from the Lodge Road to the big curve, I did that. Corps of Engineers did the upper part.
Well, and I've got to ask, I'm curious, you talk about the stretch of Highway 152, and this is in Central California, if people were ever traveling between Madera through Chowchilla to Red Top.
I'm from Las Banas, so that would be right on my way to my hometown. What would have been different had you been able to do it the way you wanted to?
I could have increased the median width between the two. We started the design when the standard for that median width was pretty restrictive. Well, I could have expanded that because we're dealing with the property owners. If you buy an inch wide or 200 feet wide, you're going to pay the same price. So I could have done that, and there was a couple of the ramps or overcrossings that this guy forced me to put the intersection at the worst possible place on the overcrossing, worst possible sight distance. And the sad thing is, the way I had it would have been cheaper.
Cheaper and safer, probably.
Oh, yeah, cheaper and safer, because this particular one I'm thinking about, they've already paid $150,000 for two suits, and it would have been cheaper to do it right to start with, but that's what I was facing.
And the other project you mentioned, when you said the four lane of Highway 168, this is if people were heading up from Fresno or anywhere in the Central Valley to Shaver Lake or Huntington Lake, where you have a lot of sailing experience, they're going to cross over this stretch of road you designed?
Corps of Engineers, like I said, built the major part of it, but I just did the bottom from about the middle of the big curve back to Lodge Road. So I got a couple of things there. You're going to have a T-intersection, and the Dry Creek was right on the other side. So I says, well, we need to put the culverts in there because anybody coming down here is going to run over that, end up in the creek. So that's a big park and ride lot now.
I know exactly what you're talking about there. Well, and you, I'm sure, have lost count of the number of times you've traversed that section of road going up to Huntington Lake for the High Sierra Regatta. I've got to hear the story, how you ended up catching this sailing bug. Where did that come from?
Well, we were, like I say, we didn't have a lot of money, so about what we could do with the family was go camping on the weekends and go trout fishing. We would camp and take off up the creek with a fly rod and do that. One of the, I think in 58, camped up there at one spot and hiked back to the Ursham Lake. It started raining just as we got outside of camp a little ways. Rained all the way up there, rained all the way back. Everything was wet. She says, let's go home. So we took everything wet, put it in the car, and came back. So the next year she rented a cabin at Huntington. And so if you go up here to Millerton, watch the sailboats out there, instead up on the dam, you used to be able to park up on the dam and watch the races or whatever's going on out there. And you see these sailboats going all which direction. You had no idea, you know. So in 1959, then, after that wet deal and all that, she rented a cabin at Huntington Lake. And there it's a long, narrow lake, and they come in close and say, you get to watching it. They look like they're having fun. So I investigated, and by golly, they were. So that was how we got interested in it.
So the guy who's been telling me he didn't have a lot of money would become the president of the Fresno Yacht Club and race up there at Huntington and all over the country for many, many years. And I don't know if we have time to tell me every race you won, but what were some of the highlights of your competitive sailing career, and who's the best crewmate you ever had?
Well, when the day sailor was my wife, she was the crew. She was good at it. And some of the other boats, well, the last race, Newport to Ensenada race, last time I had to go, I won in class, so that was 125-mile ocean race. Then I won a lot of challenge races, and first time they had a Pacific Coast Championship, I won that. I think I won that about five times, and I got two and almost another one of the North American Championship, because we included Canada, so we had a U.S. and Canada, and we won it twice.
And when you say we, you're talking about you and your wife. So for people who are novices in the sailing world, walk me through this. What kind of a vessel is this? How big is it? And what do you have to do? How well do you have to work together to get a trophy?
The boat was a 17-foot fiberglass O'Day day sailor. It had a nice cuddy cabin and good beach seats, and all that. Was a comfortable boat to sail. So what you got to do to win is, well, first, I think you have to have fun. We were having fun. That's why we got the boat. And you have to have your equipment in good shape, good sails, and you got to pay attention. I've taught lots of sailing classes, and they say, well, what's the most important? Pay attention. Because the least little, this is what I used to have a lot of fun with racing the guys at the ocean. We'd go down and race the midwinters and stuff. They would miss those little 5-degree wind shifts. I would take them, and I won most of the time.
So what you're saying is you're picking up on details that just escaped other competitors.
I hope I was.
And what about working with your partner in crime over here? I imagine that takes good communication.
She could anticipate what I was going to do, so it worked real good.
So you didn't even have to shout out those captain's commands? She was a step ahead of you?
No, I could punch her a couple of times, and easy punch. just say, do this. She knew what I was going to do, so. And that's important. And then our tacks were smooth, but it's got to be fun. I sailed as good as I could in every race, but if I didn't win, you had fun. You got to sail. Well, nobody loses a sailboat race.
I don't know if you have an answer for this or not. How many races you think you've been in?
I had a bunch of trophies that I got rid of, and I had no idea I had that many. One of the great-grandsons counted them. I think it was almost 300 that was on display, and then I had a bunch of them I'd taken the plaques off and put in shoebox and put them up in the attic and the garage and everywhere. When I started digging them out, how come I get... So we had all sorts of, I had a lot of trophies.
Well, I imagine in that mix, there had to be some fairly close races, right?
Oh, yeah. The first time I won the championship in Georgia, there was nobody close enough to us after five races. They run six races for one throwout, so I calculated out, and so I didn't have to race the last race. Drove all the way back while they were racing the last race. Went to Atlanta, 40 miles, across two counties to get champagne to celebrate our win. The second time I won in Arlington, Texas, I didn't have that cushion, but I still won. And like I say, in Lake Cowan, Ohio, I missed it by 0.25 points.
Something just tells me, too, if you have that many races, there had to be some where things didn't quite go right. Do you ever sit around and chuckle about some of the mishaps you encountered?
Oh, yeah. The first time I realized that it was a High Sierra regatta, important regatta, and in the last minute, you're running the line and picking out your point so you can hit the line right when the gun goes off, and the crystal came off my stopwatch. I had to make a maneuver. I dropped the thing, and the hand came back, so I had no idea what the time was. So I fouled, and I'm sailing back to the dock, and I says, I've just fouled out an important race, and it doesn't bother me. As luck would have it, I got back to the dock, and there was two other classes that almost the same as the guys who were top-notchers, always win, were doing the same thing I was doing. But that's the first time I realized. And I never did get, most of the time the guys get butterflies, they can't eat breakfast, they're nervous at the stop. But the start is the most important. If you can get off the start line clean and then get out in the race. So that's what I did. So when I screwed up, it didn't bother me, I still had fun.
Maybe that's part of it, but I'm just wondering, after all these decades in sailing, are there some important lessons you look at and say, I learned that because of my time out there on the water?
Well, I can't think of... I just learned to pay attention. That's it. First off, you have to have your hull. That's got to be slick. Your sails have got to be good. Your rigging has got to be easy to use without too much effort. You have to have a gentle touch to the tiller. It just got to come kind of natural.
Well, let me throw this one at you. Again, 79 years of marriage far outpaces, I'm pretty sure, just about everybody listening. I doubt there's anyone listening who's been married longer than 79 years. Do you think that all that time the two of you spent together, having to work together in these races, you think that helped your marriage?
Oh, yeah. Well, sure, yeah. We did real well. I mean, it was really kind of the highlight. We were doing something together, so I don't play golf, never had time. We go sailing. So we were doing things with the family. We were doing things with the boat. Well, my son raced a little bit. In fact, a couple of races he beat me. But not normally, not usually.
When do they do that High Sierra Regatta?
July. It's traditionally been second and third full weekends in July. One for the centerboards, one for the keelboats. I haven't sailed it in 3 years or maybe 4 years. I don't know. And they've changed their formats and stuff like that.
Well, and people who are listening say, did he just say 4 years? Because they're saying that means he was in his 90s the last time he sailed in this High Sierra Regatta. Do you ever wake up some days and say, man, I'd like to get back out on that boat right now?
I can still do it. No, it's no, I have no problems. I'm only 96, but I have no problems.
So if someone calls you up between now and July and says, hey, can I be part of your crew for the High Sierra Regatta? You're up for it?
Well, I'll probably be selling the boat before then, but yeah, I could sail the boat. Sailing is, to me, is not a solo sport. They've got those single-handers out there. The guys go out and single-hand, but it's a social sport. So, and then like having the big boat, 25 feet is a big boat. We had two couples, you know, a son. We'd have another couple as a crew, so we'd have four. So it was a social thing as well as racing, and we did pretty well.
And I mentioned, you know, half-kiddingly, the idea of the Fresno Yacht Club. What's the funniest thing you've ever heard when you show up saying, hey, I'm with the Fresno Yacht Club?
Most of the places, they knew who I was back then, but one of the things, when buying the Coronado 25, you go take a demonstration ride or whatever with the guy, where are you from? I was from Fresno. There's no water in Fresno. So, but we've gotten more sailing from Fresno than we would have gotten, say, in San Diego or somewhere else, because we can go to the mountains, we can go to the coast, we can go to regattas north-south. So we've gotten actually more sailing in from Fresno than some people that live right on the water. We enjoyed it all. Like I say, we sailed as good as we could. If we won, that was great. If we didn't, we still had fun.
I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us your story. Is there something you look back on, 96 years old now, and you say, yeah, that's what I'm most proud of?
Well, not really. I mean, I just do the best I can and everything I do, and, well, I'm kind of proud we made it 79 years.
And counting. You're on year number 80. So how'd you do that? Because I'm sure you get to ask that a lot. People want to know. You have no idea. You got to have some idea. What's the secret? What's your advice?
Well, you just got to do what you have to do when you have to do it. They add up one day at a time, one year at a time. I guess I could say I'm kind of proud of becoming a registered civil engineer with no education. I was able to pass the exam and became a civil engineer. So that was one of the things I kind of proud of. I feel an accomplishment that is almost impossible.
Yeah. I'm sure if somebody had come and told that kid in the cotton field in McFarland that he was going to do that and win all these sailing races, that he would have thought you were a little nuts.
That's right. That's it.
Well, I'm going to give her a chance to tell me you know, her secrets for 79 years of marriage. But let me give you the opportunity to talk about Ruth a little bit. After 79 years, I'm guessing you know her pretty well. And there are some things that maybe you appreciate about her. So what have you appreciated and loved about her all these years?
We've done the job we were supposed to do. You know, you get up there and you promise to do your duty to God and country and obey the Scout law. You're better or for worse, sicknesses and health, richer or poorer. So we've done it all. We've done our job.
Your turn. What's the secret of 79 years?
Accepting each other's faults.
You mean you have those?
I have them, yeah. Well, I think accepting each other's faults and make the best of it.
What have you appreciated about him?
Him taking good care of me, especially when I get sick. He's done a good job. I enjoyed the sailing most of all and crewing on the boat and winning.
Did you really know what he was going to want to do before he told you?
No. But once we got in the boat, I knew what, in a tight race, I knew what to do. I just kept my mouth shut and worked.
He's trying to remember if you kept your mouth shut. He looks a little perplexed there. Is that not the way you remember it?
But that's about it. Yeah, I have no comment to me.
And now we know how you've made it 79 years and counting. Lewis and Ruth Wagoner of Fresno, California. Find photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're out of time for today, but thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.